really excited to have Ann Charters here tonight. I sadly missed her Olson lecture when I was at a soccer game, but I had the pleasure of spending some time with her yesterday. And aside from being Kerouac's bibliographer and having two books on Olson, which I've just been rereading evidence of what was said, and I really have appreciated it, having embarked in my own work with Olson. Anne's got an incredible wealth of experiences that she draws on, firsthand experiences dealing with people that we dream of having known, or have nightmares of having known, as it may be. So I'm really excited to hear what she has to say about her viewing of history. Anne Charters.
Thank you so much. That was very kind. Well, my talk today isn't about the people I've known. It's the people I've watched on TV and read about. And my talk today came out of a wonderful breakfast that I had up the street when I was here last October talking about Charles Olson. Judith Nast invited a group of people for brunch, and it was a wonderful meal, and it was great conversation. And in the conversation, I was asked who I had admired when I was young, what I wanted to be. I don't know how we got on that, but we did. And after I left Gloucester and went back to Storrs, Connecticut, where I live most of the time, I thought, oh, if I ever come back here again, I'm going to write, you know, something for this audience. Well, I didn't know what it was going to be until I went to the library one day last winter, probably December, January, a long time after my talk in October, and I took out a box of videos that I had never looked at before from the library shelves, and that gave me my material for what I'm going to talk about. So thanks to Judith Nast and that great brunch crowd, I'm going to talk to you or read a short paper called Person to Person, Edward R. Murrow's Television Interviews in 1950s America. It's about 30 minutes long, so if you doze off, you know when I'll wake you again. Recently, to entertain myself during cold winter nights in rural Connecticut, I borrowed a box of videos from my town library that I'd never watched before. Highlights from Edward R. Murrow's early television show, Person to Person. Beginning in the fall of 1953, Murrow interviewed celebrities on CBS TV every Friday night for a half hour, starting at 10:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. His idea was to let his audience watch the stars being filmed in their own homes while he, Murrow, sat in his New York studio and talked with them over the airwaves. This use of television technology was cutting edge in 1953. The program immediately caught on, and Murrow was such a skilled interviewer that his show ran until the end of the 1950s. Has anyone here seen that when you were younger? Oh, great, great. You have things to tell me. I'll hurry through this, and then we can talk. All right. I never watched the program because I rarely looked at TV in those years. In 1950, I'd just become a teenager when my parents bought their first small screen TV for our house. But in the fall of 1953, I left home to become a freshman at the University of California in Berkeley. During my first 3 years as a college student, I lived in a dorm that didn't have a TV set in the common room. But in my senior year, I rented a small cottage in Berkeley where I could live alone. It was similar to the places that Allen Ginsberg and Gary Snyder were renting near campus and described by Kerouac in The Dharma Bums. These young poets didn't own TV sets, and neither did I. In fact, I don't recall that the idea of watching TV ever occurred to anyone I knew in Berkeley. Books, music, films, absolutely, yes. But TV? Never. So recently, when I saw the box of Murrow's interviews on the library shelf, they appealed to me. At last, I thought, with the magic of television, I could return in my early 80s to what America was like in my youth. The box set was divided into three categories: American icons, including Dick Clark, John F. Kennedy, Eleanor Roosevelt, and others; Hollywood legends, including Marlon Brando, Marilyn Monroe, Betty Davis, and so forth; and legendary entertainers, such as Frank Sinatra and Liberace. The first CD opened with the disc jockey Dick Clark's interview. It was April 25th, 1958, and what I heard and saw was so revealing that I decided to watch all the interviews. The poorly defined black and white images were a chore to focus on, but the words spoken by Dick Clark brought the time he was alive back to life. What he was saying about American teenagers and the generation gap riveted me to the screen. Today, two of my primary interests are still the same as they were in the 1950s. I first encountered them as a college student. My interests were women's lives in the United States and beat literature. Thanks to Edward R. Murrow's interviews, I could hear how a few American celebrities, some of them my role models, regarded the two topics that were to cause a great deal of controversy later on in the decade and in many decades to come. I will describe to you the person-to-person programs that shed the most light on my two interests. As a teenager, I gave a lot of thought to the question of what kind of woman I would grow up to be. That's where Judith Nast's conversation was about. When did I get involved in Olson? How did he fit into my own life? And as a teenager, I began to think about that, of course. Every woman in my family was a housewife, with the exception of one unmarried cousin. She was Cousin Eleanor, and she was a physician. My mother wanted me to follow in her own footsteps and find a husband as soon as possible, but I was determined to be different. In 1950, the average age for American brides was only 20 years old. Most of my girlfriends were getting married right out of high school, but I was determined to have a career. Witnessing the long-term effects of my parents' struggle to survive in the Great Depression, I knew I wanted to achieve financial independence, but I hadn't a clue about what other qualities I wanted in my life after I finished college. So, interested in female role models, I watched with great interest one of Murrow's earliest interviews on October 30th, 1953. It was with Senator John F. and Jacqueline Kennedy just a month after their marriage. They were interviewed in the living room of the senator's bachelor apartment in Boston, not far from Beacon Hill, while the couple searched for a home in Washington, D.C. This interview gave me a close glimpse of Kennedy already sounding presidential as he monopolized the conversation. His bride was 24 years old and startlingly beautiful. Jackie was the perfect age to get married, I thought. But I was highly critical of her behavior during the conversation with Murrow. She was clearly intelligent, but she'd been so well drilled to accept what a woman's proper place in politics, and that was to be seen and not heard. The interview was obviously made to promote her husband's career. Because Jackie made no eye contact with the camera, looking at her husband when she was talking, and when she wasn't, she was watching Murrow's image on a screen outside the camera's range. She started the program by answering three or four questions with single sentences, speaking clearly in a low voice, explaining how she met the senator and describing their wedding gifts. And then she left the room. John F. remained in front of the camera during the entire half hour after her, talking steadily about his father and the experiences he and his older brother had in World War II. He was very modest, referring to his heroism during World War II after his PT boat's disastrous confrontation with the Japanese destroyer in the Pacific. He called it an interesting experience. When Jackie came back into the living room, cutting short her husband's knowledgeable monologue about the necessary reforms to the Taft-Hartley Act currently underway in Congress, Jack broke off to say, "I see my wife is back." Jackie said, "I brought your favorite wedding present, a football." Jack said, "Ah, Harvard was going to use it in its first game. I really appreciate the gift." After this brief exchange, he then picked up where he'd left off. And he went on to answer Murrow's next question about how Americans could avoid a possible economic recession. Sitting beside him on the sofa, Jackie gazed at him in adoring silence. Finally, to end the program, Murrow thanked the senator for the interview and asked him to, quote, "express our thanks to Mrs. Kennedy," unquote. Well, the attractive wife was still visible on the screen, sitting on the sofa next to her voluble husband. But she never got a chance to say her own goodbye to Murrow. Well, if Jackie was the perfect 1950s poster wife on Person to Person, then Murrow's interview with Eleanor Roosevelt 3 months later, January 22, 1954, showed a very different political wife, one I liked a lot better. Mrs. Roosevelt was free to show her independent spirit, though, of course, she was neither young nor beautiful. At the age of 69, she was working at the UN and flying around the world giving speeches. Since I had been a little girl, I'd been her admirer because my favorite great aunt Blanche, who was actually the mother of my unmarried doctor cousin Eleanor, my aunt Blanche read the columns of Eleanor Roosevelt and quoted her approvingly about how citizens of all ages and walks of life could contribute to the war effort during World War II. Like millions of other television viewers, I welcomed the chance to get a glimpse of Mrs. Roosevelt in her own home. After she became a widow and left the White House, she lived alone in Manhattan in a 5-room duplex apartment in the East 60s. Murrow was respectful of all the people he invited to appear on his program, but he became almost courtly when interviewing Mrs. Roosevelt. She wore a long, simply cut silk dress with 3/4 length sleeves, sensible flat shoes, a triple strand of small pearls around her neck, curly gray hair, and a wide, ready smile. Murrow seemed amazed that a woman whom he considered to be so aged at 69 could continue to be so active. And she told him, "I do all the work that comes my way," including her daily newspaper column, which took her 30 minutes to dictate to a secretary, and her correspondence. She personally answered every letter written to her, as she said, "that is signed," unquote. She said often her letters were from her critics, but she was sustained by her guiding thought that you have, quote, "to do the best you can in this world. And if you've done that, it's the best you can do," unquote. Now, I'd heard that before. My husband, Sam, had said it to me during a tough time in my life. I had taken it as his maxim, but now I know where he'd gotten it. When Murrow asked Mrs. Roosevelt which of her achievements she was most proud of, she replied, quote, "I don't know if I'd call anything I've done an achievement," unquote. But she quickly decided she was most proud to have attended the first session of the UN in London in 1946. She recalled that I, quote, "I'd gone in fear and trembling because I was the first woman there. And a woman must do well or it hurts all women." At the end of the session, she continued, when we'd had disagreements about the return of refugees against their will to their country of origin, both John Foster Dulles and Senator Arthur Vandenberg were kind enough to tell me when they were saying goodbye that they were glad I'd been part of the delegation. I knew they'd begged President Truman not to appoint me, but they'd found it good to work with me, and that pleased me. That was very gratifying. I mean, one could analyze that. Oh, we could go in so many directions with that one, right? But anyway, Mrs. Roosevelt's lack of pretension and her open heart captivated me. Watching her interview now, or last winter, when I just turned 81, I felt we shared a common understanding about how to live. At the end of the program, Murrow asked her straight out, "Mrs. Roosevelt, why do you work so hard?" Her answer was simplicity itself. It sounded like the way I would answer from my own life experience if asked the same question. "What else would I do?" answered Mrs. Roosevelt. "I live alone. My children are busy and have lives of their own. I don't want them to be worrying about mother having nothing to do." End of quote. Mwah. Okay. Actually, I took two famous women as role models when I entered my teens. Beside Eleanor Roosevelt, I'd also greatly admired the film actress Esther Williams. She was a terrific swimmer, and I love to swim myself. I enjoyed every one of Esther Williams' movies when I was a kid, though I did feel a tad uneasy about how she managed to keep her sculptured elaborate hairdo from getting ruined underwater. But I found that Edward R. Murrow had a warm spot for Esther, too. He interviewed her and her husband on February 11, 1955. But Esther's behavior on Person to Person didn't impress me at all. Her life appeared to be everything my mother wanted for me. Esther had a rich, devoted husband, three young kids, and a total absorption in conspicuous consumption. She seemed obsessed with clothes, especially the starched crinoline petticoats popular in the mid-1950s. I loathed them. She wore yards of crinoline herself under a clinched waist, very fancy dress. Her 18-month-old daughter wore a starched crinoline under her little dress, too. Esther told Murrow proudly that she'd sewn miniature cloth rosebuds onto her baby's crinoline, and she held up the squirming infant for us to see her tiny petticoat. What a waste of time, I thought. Well, Murrow said he'd like to see her swimming pool after she told us she swam 40 laps every morning to keep in shape. But instead, Esther insisted on showing off her large, state-of-the-art laundry room. A birthday present from her husband. It was the best present she ever had, she told us, because it made it so easy to keep her children's clothes clean and neatly folded. Otherwise, you know, it's a big chore. Well, I found this interview deflating, to say the least. 3 months later, April 8, 1955, Marilyn Monroe was another disappointment. Murrow introduced her with the comment, and he rarely said these sorts of things, that she had taken 5 hours to apply her makeup before the broadcast. Marilyn was interviewed while staying at the home of her friends, the photographer Milton Green and his wife. She was very beautiful. But she seemed to be so shy or stoned that she had nothing much to say. But Betty Davis now, that was another story. I admired her feisty performances in many films. On September 21, 1956, about the time I was settling as a senior into my backyard cottage in Berkeley, she and her husband Gary Merrill were interviewed in their large house off the main coast. She had just finished making Storm Center, a film in which she played a librarian, championing freedom of thought in the shockwaves of book burning during the McCarthy trials. Davis was suggesting to Murrow, she of course wouldn't say it outright on CBS, that she preferred living on an island in Maine to enduring the devastating climate in Hollywood. She preferred Maine to Hollywood because she wanted to avoid the communist witch hunts in California. After obligingly fetching a large live lobster to illustrate one of her husband's fishing stories, Davis read aloud Robert Frost's poem, Fire and Ice, and that was the only literature on the entire program. fire and ice. She might have been able to find the carefully scrubbed lobster waiting off stage in her kitchen, but she was not your typical housewife. Her down-to-earth husband said that if his wife could do what she liked, she'd probably want to be president of Lord & Taylor, the department store. I love it. He credited her honesty and drive for her success as an actress. But Betty Davis told Murrow that she found taking care of a home, she was so outspoken, is one of the hardest jobs from the standpoint of monotony. I love that one. Whenever I go back to work, I tell my family I'm taking a holiday. Betty's candor about the limitations of her life as a housewife and her indirect protest against the McCarthy era, they won my heart. Finally, on the topic of feminism and women's roles in the 1950s, I watched Murrow's interview with Elizabeth Taylor, whom he said had been voted one of the 10 most beautiful women in the world. Well, in my view, she was the most beautiful. There was no question about it. She appeared on Person to Person on April 5th, 1957. That was 3 months after her marriage to the millionaire tycoon Mike Todd, who had just won his first Oscar for producing the film Around the World in 80 Days. Liz had just finished making Raintree County. Taylor looked very thin and very fragile, but unlike Marilyn Monroe, she radiated happiness at the sight of her husband, Mike Todd. Murrow asked her, "Are you going to continue making movies, or are you going to become a housewife?" Before she could answer, Todd said, "Oh, this new Liz, she's always ready, but it's very difficult to get her to do the dishes for me." During the entire interview, Liz cradled a baby duck in her arms. It was supposed to be a present for the children. They had children from various marriages. Todd told Murrow that if the kids don't ask to see the duck, we'll have it for dinner. Liz pretended to be offended, and he went on, "I'll make my career taking care of ducks and children." Well, that interview was clearly not fodder for my investigation into the status of feminism and women's rights in the 1950s. Taylor wasn't one of my heroes. She was a superhero, and I decided she was too big to be contained in my narrow categories. She told Murrow, quote, that Mike is the nicest person I ever lived with. He's a wonderful man with a sense of humor, generous, sympathetic, and he's a marvelous cook, unquote. I like Mike Todd too, especially after he showed us, with great pleasure, a simple sketch of his father on the wall behind him. That was right after he walked us past the other paintings on the wall by Claude Monet, Camille Pissarro, and Frans Hals. He really was very rich. Just as I'd reacted to watching Jackie and Jack Kennedy, I was saddened to remember the tragedy of the untimely violent deaths of both Mike Todd, he died in an airplane crash shortly after the interview, and President Kennedy. Murrow's interviews had captured two larger-than-life couples' brief time of happiness together. It was very poignant to watch these two couples because they really loved each other. Murrow's program also suggested the climate in the United States when beat literature first appeared, beginning with his interview with Marlon Brando, October 1, 1955. This was 6 months before Allen Ginsberg read the first part of Howl and caused a sensation at the Six Gallery in San Francisco. At the time of Murrow's interview, Brando was filming Guys and Dolls. He was living with his father in a sparsely furnished house in Hollywood. The two men clearly didn't like each other very much. They sat stiffly side by side in the living room with their legs crossed in a similar way. Then, while his father was talking in front of the camera, Brando stood up abruptly and left the room. And the camera followed him, his father disappeared, and Brando went downstairs where there were bongo drums set out. And he sat down and played a long, passionate, improvised duet on the bongos with a music teacher who appeared at his side. That was Brandon. He didn't seem settled in Hollywood. He told Murrow that the only personal thing he had in the rented house, quote, is a portrait of my mother at 40, but she died, and I miss her very much, unquote. He was as handsome as he appeared in the films, very self-possessed, very articulate. Like Ginsberg and Kerouac, he was highly critical of the prevailing American cultural standards. The movies are an industry, he said, not an art. I think they should appeal to what is more elevated in people rather than what is common to people. Then he said, everyone associates me with the part I played in Streetcar Named Desire, and it's hard to live that down, unquote. The televised interview with Frank Sinatra, September 14, 1956, was another surprise. Sinatra had flown to L.A. from Las Vegas to do the interview only minutes before the program started. And then it ended abruptly, scarcely a half hour later, when the driver of the car taking him back to the airport to return to his casino show in Vegas wouldn't stop blowing his horn. I mean, it was like, wow, this is a big guy, Sinatra, if he can get away with that. Sinatra had just moved to a newly built, elegant, and extremely expensive house in Hollywood that he'd commissioned from a Japanese architect. This was 2 years before The Dharma Bums was published, so it taught me that the influence of Japanese philosophy and architecture in the United States was clearly here to stay. Sinatra told Murrow that though he'd won an Oscar for his film From Here to Eternity, he was proudest of the role he'd played in The Man with the Golden Arm, about a World War II vet who was addicted to heroin or morphine. The film actually was heroin. The film was an adaptation of Nelson Algren's gritty novel about a drug-addicted World War II veteran in Chicago, and it was a precursor to the works of beat fiction of Burroughs and, of course, poetry of Ginsberg and many others. By the late 1950s, two person-to-person interviews dealt with topics that, to me, were firmly associated at the time with beat writing. One was the raucous new pop music, rock and roll, and the disruptive younger generation. The Beats got incredible, incredible criticism, especially Kerouac, for having been writers who idolized or talked about the lifestyle of young people, which were very much an affront to American values. But on April 25th, 1958, the disc jockey, Dick Clark, most of you probably last saw him at Times Square during, you know, the ceremony of the New Year's Eve. But he started off as a 22-year-old disc jockey with his own show, American Bandstand, on ABC. And he was genuinely impressed that, I mean, Murrow was genuinely impressed that so many new records, there were over 200 new songs a week being sent to Clark's program to be put onto the air. Clark was very self-possessed at 22. He was asked if today's teenagers are a mystery, and he gave a very swift, authoritarian reply. He had very young children in his own marriage. According to him, there was nothing mysterious about the younger generation. Kids like rock and roll, but it's not as disruptive as adults think. If parents, according to Clark, took only 15 minutes a day to talk to their kids and asked why they liked rock and roll, they'd find it out. But instead, according to Clark, a recent survey showed the average parents in America take only 4 minutes a week to talk to their children. That was pretty stunning, because I thought parents are even busier today. But it was beginning already by 1958. And Clark didn't think there was a generation gap. In his opinion, the name teenager, just putting a label on the kids, is the problem. He said, you never see a newspaper headline saying a middle-ager gets in trouble or holds up a store. Clark's defense of teenagers was a refreshing change from the standard media attack at the time on the new generation of so-called troubled kids. In 1952, the beat writer John Cleland Holmes had written an essay, This is the Beat Generation, for the New York Times. Holmes started, I think, a bad way in that essay by replying to Life magazine's attack on what it called drug-crazed teenagers. In the opening paragraph, Holmes defended an 18-year-old California girl in the magazine who'd been picked up by the police for smoking marijuana. He said that in her photograph, her face was no hint, there was no hint of corruption. And her face, the 18-year-old marijuana smoker, was the face of the Beat Generation, unquote. How long it takes, right? God, it goes on and on. The difference between Clark and Holmes, of course, was that every day Clark interacted with hundreds of teenagers on his program, whereas Holmes had no children of his own and had no contact with any teenagers in Old Saybrook. He only learned about them from magazines. The second of the reissued interviews that covered similar ground, championed by the Beat writers, was with actors Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward. Soon to celebrate their first wedding anniversary, expecting their first child, they just moved into a duplex apartment in Greenwich Village. She had won an Oscar for her performance in The Three Faces of Eve, and he had completed a film of Tennessee Williams' play, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. Murrow began the interview on December 26, 1958, by asking Joanne, "Is it true that Paul Newman is a rebel?" The couple laughed, and she replied, "No, he's a Republican." And as we know from the salad dressing, he really was. Paul picked it up from there. He was wonderful. "We live in an age of conformity. We live in an age of," that's what the Beats were saying, "and if you don't travel with a herd, you're branded as a rebel. I'm trying desperately, I hope, to be an individual. I see rebels at parties." This is the height of the Beat Generation. On the Road was published. Ginsberg had been published. It was going strong, and it was all over the newspapers. "I see rebels," says Paul Newman, "at parties in Greenwich Village, sitting alone and feeling sensitive, but I can't stand them. They're just as mediocre as the people they despise, the conformists. The rebel always has to say no to everything society asks of him, just as the conformist always has to say yes. In our society, we try to go through life making as few enemies as possible and causing as little friction as possible, and that makes Jack a pretty dull boy." Murrow then asked, "How do you account for this conformity, Paul?" And the answer came swiftly, "I think it would have delighted Charles Olson and Allen Ginsberg." Ginsberg was living at the time very close. He was a neighbor of Paul Newman's in the East Village, where only a couple of months earlier, he'd written Kaddish. Newman told Murrow, quote, "The individual seems to be getting smaller and smaller, not because he wants to, but because the machine that surrounds him is getting bigger and bigger." Does that sound like Olson? It does to me. "Big business is bigger. The bomb is certainly bigger. And for the individual to buck that is difficult. He can only destroy himself, really." Paul Newman could have been phrasing Ginsberg's letter the previous year to his father, Louis. That was on November 30th, 1957, quote. Allen wrote, "People keep seeing destruction or rebellion in Jack's writing and Howell, but that's a very minor element. Actually, it only seems to be so to people who have accepted standard American values as permanent," unquote. Newman was certainly on Ginsberg's wavelength when he went on to tell Murrow, quote, "There's an emotional conformity here. Recently, I saw a wonderful photograph in an Italian magazine of a World War II veteran coming home. All his relatives welcomed him. They engulfed him. And the emotions displayed were a revelation to me. I've seen this happen so differently in American railroad stations. The father sticks out his hands and mutters, 'Was it a tough battle, kid?' The kid looks back and says, 'Yes, Pop, but I kept a stiff upper lip.' For someone to sit on his emotions all the time is what I'd call emotional republicanism," unquote. Well, Ginsberg was arguing in his letter with his father about capitalism, writing him that American society had accepted values that were not, quote, "really standard nor permanent," unquote. What Ginsburg and his friends wanted was individuals taking responsibility, saying what they actually feel. And that's exactly what Paul Newman was talking about with the Italian father embracing his kids. I wouldn't have put down television if I'd watched Edward R. Murrow. His interview with Newman was the day after Christmas in 1958. Then I was a frugal student in graduate school at Columbia University. I'd left California. I lived in a little room without a TV set, and I was planning my wedding for the coming spring. Now I'm glad I found Murrow's programs in the library. Person to Person was definitely well worth watching, especially since while its magic lasted, it banished the winter's cold and darkness waiting outside my Connecticut windows. Thank you. Well, Judith, see, you did that. Judith, it was your house and your party, and I just said, people are interested in what I was like growing up. Well, there I am, you know. That's what I wrote this about. Do you have anything to add? Those of you who have seen the programs, were there programs that were ones you really remember? Yeah?
Oh, yeah. So every Sunday night, last week,
of course, Murrow always had a cigarette.
And it was unbelievable because it was like style and you could always smell it.
Yeah.
But it was really fabulous to be in most people's homes.
Thanks. Anyone else remember watching them or what you liked about them? Yeah.
I remember all the smoking.
Yeah, right.
My father smoked and everybody smoked.
Everybody smoked. My dad did too. Yeah. It was all in the house. Yeah, of course.
And it seemed like it was honest, spontaneous.
Smoking?
No, just the way he conducted.
Oh, right. Well, Murrow was. Yeah.
You know. I mean, I was just a kid. But
you noticed that. He was so debonair.
Yeah.
And he could handle anything. Yeah.
But it was the voice, too.
Yeah.
Right.
The voice
right.
was complete authority.
Exactly.
When that sound came out of his mouth,
exactly. No, that's very true. I'm glad you mentioned that, the quality of the sound of that voice. Yeah, no, he was the soul of urbane sophistication, good breeding, everything you could think of, and quick intelligence, too. He had been there, done that, seen it, and can talk about it, and that voice would tell you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. No, I watched other things that he did, of course, and his story is pretty fantastic itself, but these interviews were just the king. Yeah, were great for me to find in the library.
You said 58?
53 to 58.
That you chose?
Beginning in the fall of 53. And it ran until the end of the 50s. I don't have a date here. So he got a good run, at least 5 years, 5-6 years out of that program. And it was, of course, 10:30 at night, so no kid would be up to see it. And it would be on the West Coast at 7:30, which is a wonderful time, after supper. Anybody else have something to say? Any questions? Yeah?
How did all those experiences and self-declarations shape your early adulthood?
Well, since I didn't watch the program, I was so contemptuous of public television. I mean, I watch films and books, just like I said.
Right.
So,
But you said you wanted to depart.
Oh, right. Now looking back.
From your female family culture.
Yeah. Well, most that was what I. That's why I was so interested in movie stars, because they, of course, had jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I ever wanted to be an actress or thought of myself, even though I grew up in L.A. while I was forming my self-image, you might say. The only one was my cousin Eleanor, the doctor. I told this to my husband when I was, writing. I also worked on a memoir. So this was years ago. I said, you know, in my family, all the women were housewives. And in his family, he was hung up because they all had been soldiers. They had been in different wars. And to not be a soldier in his family culture was a terrible thing. So as a little boy, he wanted, you know, to be a soldier. And he enlisted in the Korean War. It was a big disappointment, as you can well imagine. It was a terrible experience. But for me, having had only housewives, I didn't know how to apply even to college. You know, why was I want to go? And I think I talked about Eleanor Roosevelt. She was my only role model, you know, except the movie stars. And I knew women wrote books. I did. And I had actually read a biography of Marie Curie by her daughter. And so I decided I'd be a physical chemist. I would work in radium like, Madame Curie. And actually, I went to Berkeley for that reason. They had a cyclotron, unlike UCLA. And I lasted one semester in physics. My mind didn't work that way. And then I realized years later that it wasn't physical chemistry and Madame Curie that had attracted me when I read that biography. It was a biography. And, you know, that's what I became, a biographer. But I didn't have the literary sophistication, even though I was trying to read the entire Echo Park library shelves, you know, from A to Z. I still didn't have the abstract ability to say a biographer or a novelist or a poet or whatever. I was so stuck in that housewife and my parents' expectations for me, which was to live at home, go to UCLA, forget about physical chemistry, look for a Jewish husband. I wasn't allowed to have anyone in the house as a date. No one could date me who wasn't Jewish, you know, or come to the house as my friend. That was like, they weren't religious, they weren't Orthodox. They had nothing to do, they didn't believe in God, but they still were Jewish. And that wasn't to be taken lightly, it's not a joke. There was so much anti-Semitism that we faced as a Jewish family that's how they expressed the rage that they felt inside.
Just a few years after the Holocaust.
That's exactly, yeah, growing up at that point. I was born in 36, so my dad didn't go to war. He had terrible eyesight. But it was just understood we would continue to be a Jewish family, you know, even though we weren't a religious family because of the millions of Jews who had died. So it wasn't a joke. You didn't argue with them about it. That's how they felt. The only way I could argue was with my feet. So I left. And we never reconciled, really. The fact that I didn't believe that was a value that I wanted to have in my own life, so I married for love, not for religion. No, this was nothing about that in Edward R. Murrow. But that's what I was casting about beyond the ghetto of my own personal family, you know? Television, I could have sat at home. My mother would have, 10:30, I'm not sure they would have wanted me to be up so late. So it was a very strict household that I came out of. But we watched Liberace, of course. I didn't write about him. I didn't have to. Anyway, other questions? Yeah.
Do we know how Murrow came to be in the position he was in? What's his background?
No, there are wonderful books about him. He's a very famous guy, and his career was like legendary, because that voice that he had, the appearance he had, the voice he had, the self-possession, the wit, the intelligence to do this so well, and it probably was during World War II, but I can't tell you. Yeah, but you could find out. Just Google it. Marvelous. He was a journalist. Yeah. I should have known more about him. Sorry, this is just for tonight.
Did he have a closing remark at the end of each interview?
Didn't he say something every program? Goodbye and good luck? Thank you.
That was the name of the movie.
That's the movie.
The George Clooney movie.
Okay, about Edward R. Murrow. You can watch that. Goodbye and good luck.
Good night.
Good night. Good night. No, say it again.
I think so. Good night and good luck.
Good night and good luck. Okay, that's the movie with George Clooney playing him. I wanted to bring you, one of the box things so we could look at Esther Williams or whoever it is you wanted to.
But on YouTube?
I imagine they're all on YouTube. But I went to the library before I drove up here to get the box, and of course, it wasn't there. The library is the library. Things come, things go. They don't own it, so they had borrowed it. When I got this in six, I don't know how many months ago. It was after the October Olson talk. Obviously, it was the middle of winter, and I was still haunted by that brunch, that brunch and the conversation after the frittata. So I just got into it. I thought, yes, I'll do this, and then people will know what I was like, what it was like for me growing up. How did I get into Olson? Well, that was a natural. But with, as Olson said, you're born in Bridgeport, and I was born in Worcester, and Jack Kerouac was born in Lowell. Hey, we're made for each other. yes, yes, he knew. Well, thank you for coming. Thank you.